Duncan, Judge Diaz, and Judge Keenan. My name is Brad Weiss. I represent Manhattan. And what I'd like to do this morning to begin with is just give you a little bit about the philosophy of the automotive industry and the intersection of contracts, statutory interpretation, and public policy. And then I'd like to address a few issues. It's been briefed on both sides, and I know that you've read the briefs. The relationship between automobile dealers and manufacturers is often a contentious one in which there's friction between the two parties. The manufacturer, as identified in the Orrin W. Fox case that I cite in my brief, sets forth that relationship and the controversies that the two parties have. In that relationship, there are state statutes that are passed in order to provide protections for dealers. In this case in particular, Maryland, like many other states, passed two particular statutes, 15207 and 15206.1, and within 15207, it incorporated 15206.1, 15206.1 being the good faith standard, not the same as the Dealer Day in Court Act, a commercial standard under the UCC, a little bit more far-reaching. In 15207, a particular statute invoking three provisions within that statute. I believe it's A subsection 2, D1, and D2. And D1 deals with de-dueling, which is the process of removing one franchise that's already in place, and D2 dealing with substantial financial hardship. And here's how all of this interplays then with contract interpretation, integration clauses, and the world economy. The manufacturers often want certain things from dealers in that relationship. They want dealers to sell vehicles and to build magnificent facilities. Dealers, on the other hand, are often small businesses in a community. They want to sell cars and trucks in those certain circumstances. In this case, it began with Ford Motor Company that had a plan, it's identified in the record, to have what's called the Premier Automotive Group. They had acquired the Jaguar franchise as a division. They acquired Land Rover as a subsidiary. They acquired Aston Martin. They acquired Volvo, and they had Lincoln Mercury during those time periods, and they wanted to have it organized as a PAG. That was the testimony from Mr. Somero, as a Premier Automotive Group. And so in this cycle, the manufacturer wants consolidation of these brand franchises. Mr. Jaffe is a Jaguar dealer with Ford, is then given the opportunity to purchase a Land Rover franchise, and interposed in that relationship is a performance agreement and then a letter of intent mandating the de-dueling of a Lincoln Mercury franchise. At the same time, Ford then goes on to sell its Premium Automotive Group franchises, in particular Jaguar and Land Rover, to ultimately what's known as Tata Motors, which is an Indian company. At the same time these events are occurring, they're mandating ultimately the de-dueling of the Lincoln Mercury franchise. They want substantial improvements done to the franchise, and they invoke a business builder program. Now, Mr. Sullivan will tell you it's voluntary, you don't have to do it, but here's the problem. In the business builder program, the manufacturer or distributor holds up to 3% of the MSRP for an incentive. So if a dealer such as Manhattan is selling a Land Rover for $70,000 and they're withholding 3% or $2,100, it puts them at a competitive disadvantage to another dealer if they don't have those incentive payments.
But your client knew all of that going into this purchase of the Land Rover franchise.
I don't disagree.
Okay. So why does this statute, this coercion statute, even apply on facts like this? Isn't this more intended to be coercion with respect to a pre-existing relationship?
I don't think so, Judge Diaz. And of course, the district court disagreed with me, but let me try and articulate to you why I think this is the intersection of both statute, contract. The letter of intent was signed, I believe, on March 2nd of 2006. The franchise agreement was signed on March 16th of 2006. Paragraph 14.5 of the standard terms and conditions drafted by Jaguar Land Rover, not drafted by the dealer, a contract of adhesion, set forth an integration and merger clause that said there are no other agreements. They could have incorporated the letter of intent, but they did not. Moreover, paragraph 14.5, the very next paragraph in, and it's in the appendix, is a modification statute that says by Jaguar Land Rover that no course of dealing can change or modify this agreement. So they made a conscious decision. There's no evidence, I believe, in the record that they made a mistake, that there was some ambiguity in the agreement. They specifically chose not to incorporate the letter of intent. By not incorporating the letter of intent, there was no obligation to de-dual within that franchise agreement. Let me just cite for you, it's not in my brief, but I believe you can take knowledge of it. The Maryland statute requires when a manufacturer distributor becomes licensed in the state to submit a copy of its franchise agreement. And this brings me to my point. My point is that I believe what happened here is that Jaguar Land Rover chose to contract around a mandatory statute. The statute says if you have a pre-existing agreement, which they did, they had a pre-existing franchise with Lincoln Mercury, that the statute does not allow them to force you to de-dual. They could conversely say in a franchise agreement, we want only an exclusive location, and as a condition of being a franchise dealer and in the franchise agreement, set forth you will be an exclusive Land Rover dealer. They didn't do that. So what I'm suggesting to you, you may disagree with me, but what I think I'm suggesting to you in the briefs is that under 15207D1, they could not obligate and require the dealer to de-dual Lincoln Mercury even if there was a letter of intent out there. So I'm going to argue both ways. Number one, it wasn't incorporated, but assuming it was for argument's sake. Yes, ma'am. Assuming it was for argument's sake, I still don't think they could do it because they cannot, and this is the reason why I was mentioning the Fox case as I began my introduction, is that the power of the manufacturer, I mean, the manufacturers are billion-dollar companies. The power in the relationship with the dealer is one in which I liken it to the manufacturer being an overlord and the dealer being a tenant farmer. They have to do what they're told to do. And that's why we interpose these statutes. The public policy is to protect these small franchises. So when you look at 15207 D1 and D2, there is a public policy to protect the dealers from the overreaching, and that's also why Maryland, like many states, requires the manufacturer distributor to file the franchise agreement. So in this case, they don't include those requirements in the franchise agreement, both by the integration and the modification clause, and because it would be illegal under Maryland law, I assert to you.
Let's say, and I'm not suggesting this, but if we agree with you that perhaps the de-dueling requirement is problematic, I guess one of the problems I have with this case is it seems like your client wants to have its cake and eat it too. That is, it wants the incentives but doesn't want to take up the requirements that are associated with those incentives. Can you help me with that?
That's a fair question. I don't think that's the case. And there's an awful lot in the appendix about the zoning issues. Let me just address that for a moment because that's also part of my introduction. And that is that I've said this before, maybe you'll be the judges that agree with me. In 2007, we had an economic tsunami that rolled over the world. We had car manufacturers that were forced into bankruptcy. We had automobile dealers that were forced by agreements to build facilities they could not maintain and went out of business. This dealer, because it had Lincoln Mercury and the emails in the appendix support it, said and told them he had an economic hardship. He had to have the money from Lincoln Mercury to survive. Those events are what is behind 15207 D1 and D2 to protect the dealer in the worst case scenario. Let me address your issue about the incentive payments. The dealer did make modifications and did go about doing things that were requested. They made changes to the facility.
But the problem is bigger than just the de-dueling. There were project milestones, and as I recall, you the deal you your client successfully completed only the first milestone, then sought to extend the remaining deadlines. When Jaguar proposed new deadlines and extended deadlines pursuant to a new agreement, the dealer declined to sign that agreement.
Yes.
Even though Jaguar attempted to revise the deadlines again, Manhattan rejected those amendments too. So it seems as though there was an attempt to address the concerns and the necessary delays in addition to the issues with de-dueling.
Yeah, yes, Justice Duncan. And let me explain it in this way. In the appendix, you'll see there's a lot of discussion about the zoning issues that were going on in Montgomery County. Montgomery County is one of the most difficult counties for zoning issues. They're very strict. And there was a White Flint sector program in place to overall change the character of Rockville. So you have that going on, and you have the economic tsunami, and you have the demands by Jaguar. There were things they wanted done that were impossible to be done. And that, combined with the economic circumstances, under 15207D2, made it impossible. And even if the dealer had signed that additional letters of intent, I believe they'd be illegal under the statute. I do. And the reason is, Judge Duncan, is that the manufacturer and distributor is mandated by law to file the franchise agreement, a form agreement. So what they're doing, if they do these subsequent letters of intents or performance agreements, they're not submitting those to the state. They're contracting around a state statute. And that's where I see the intersection of this case, which is, does the state statute trump the contract? Does the contract trump the state statute, given that economic hardship was inputted into the statute to govern these situations?
But if the agreement is invalidated, then doesn't that take your incentive payments out of play as well?
I'm not suggesting that the agreement, the franchise agreement, is invalidated. I don't think it is.
The obligations that it imposes on you, but not the obligations that it imposes on the
I would respectfully disagree, and this is the reason why. If you follow my argument that the letter of intent was not incorporated into the franchise agreement, was not part of it, then there was no obligation, and they've met the requirements, at least the minimum requirements, for the business builder program.
The district court found that the interpretation of an integration clause is itself subject a matter of interpretation, and it looked at the fact that all of these agreements were signed either at the same time or within a couple of days of one another.
2 weeks.
And that when read together, clearly evinced an intent to reflect a totality.
Well, that's interesting, because you may want.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, yes.
That's what the district court said, and if you accept, if it's correct, and as I understand Maryland law, it does seem to be, that even the effect of an integration clause is subject to interpretation. Why is that not a plausible interpretation?
Well, it's interesting, because when Mr. Sullivan gets up, he's going to articulate to you, I anticipate, that they were two completely separate agreements. That's what he briefed it. Mm-hmm. So how do we have an integration clause that now is being interpreted to incorporate it as part of the franchise agreement when he contends they're separate?
According to the district court, as covering a universe, a total universe that can be interpreted harmoniously.
The court did do that, and they cited the two principal cases. One was the Shoreham case from 1976. The other was the Guarantee case, which was a bankruptcy case, I think, from the Western District of Virginia. I suggest to you that if you look at the other cases in Maryland, they pretty much follow the objective interpretation of contracts. Jaguar is the one that's arguing somehow there's an ambiguity. They're the ones that put the documents together. They're the ones that decide what goes in and what doesn't go into the agreement. And essentially, their position is they made a mistake, they made an error, and there's no affidavit and no testimony to that. Final point on my main argument is that if you look at the Statement of Material Facts in Dispute, there's 117 paragraphs of material facts that are alleged to be in dispute. Mr. Jaffe gave an affidavit in opposition to the summary judgment in which he set forth the economic financial hardship issue in the dueling with Lincoln Mercury. Thank you very much.
Mr. Sullivan?
May it please the court, my name is John Sullivan and I represent the appellant Jaguar Land Rover in this case. Jaguar and Land Rover moved for summary judgment on their declaratory judgment claim and for summary judgment against the counterclaims that were filed by Manhattan. And on the declaratory judgment claim, Jaguar, I'm going to just say Jaguar to simplify it, Jaguar's simply saying that Manhattan's not entitled to the facility-related business builder money because they don't qualify under the rules of the business builder program. Under those rules, the dealer must either have an approved facility or an approved facility plan. And it's undisputed on this record that Manhattan has neither one of those things. Jaguar Land Rover is not saying that the dealer had to perform the specific agreements that were dated May 2nd, 2006 in order to obtain those funds. But if it's not going to perform that approved plan, then it needs to come up with a new one. And a new one could have involved keeping Lincoln Mercury in the dealership. And just as a footnote, I don't think Mercury exists anymore. It went out of business last year. But I said on the record in court at the preliminary injunction hearing over 3 years ago, and it's on the record, that we would have negotiated, or Jaguar would negotiate a deal to keep Lincoln Mercury in the facility as long as the dealership met the current capacity requirements, the current branding requirements, and the current design requirements of the business builder program. And Manhattan's position has been, we're not going to do anything. Give us the money. Now, they argue that these agreements are invalid due to the statute. But even if those agreements are invalid, how does that entitle them to the money? They still don't have an approved facility plan or an approved facility under the rules. And they're really taking the position here that unlike all the other dealers who comply with the rules and make the investment and do the design and the branding and meet the capacity requirements, that they should get the money like everybody else. So in our view, the only relief that Manhattan is seeking in this case is the business building money. There's no other claims for damages in the case. So in our view, even if these agreements were invalid, they still wouldn't be entitled to the relief that they're asking for because they don't satisfy the rules. However, if they're seeking a determination from the court, and I understand their argument is that this was coercion, we cut off the money in order to enforce the agreement, so that was addressed in the district court, and I believe it was addressed correctly by the district court. Their first argument is that the Land Rover form dealer agreement nullified the letter of intent. And as the district court found, that clearly was not the intent of the parties. As Judge Duncan pointed out, the agreements were all sent in a single email as a package of agreements to be signed in connection with Manhattan's acquisition of the Land Rover dealership. They all signed together. In addition, the Jaguar agreement had to be amended as well because Manhattan was introducing a new franchise, into the Jaguar facility, and Manhattan didn't have the right to do that without Jaguar's consent. So clearly, the Land Rover dealer agreement integration clause can nullify the Jaguar performance agreement. The two don't have a relation to each other. And Manhattan itself contends that it continued to perform the letter of intent and the performance agreement for months after the Land Rover dealer agreement was signed, and that it spent significant time and resources, it says on page 16 of his brief, to comply with those agreements. So obviously it didn't believe that there was any intent to nullify those agreements. We submit that the district judge correctly relied on the Shoreham case where the Maryland High Court held that even when there's an integration clause in one of two agreements that are signed with respect to the same transaction, you don't nullify one of the agreements when it's apparent that that was not the party's intent. And finally, as the district judge also pointed out, the letter of intent and dealer agreement don't deal with the same subject matter. The letter of intent specifies the specific requirements for Manhattan's facility, and the dealer agreement does not. And in that connection, I just want to address the argument that Mr. Weiss made about the Maryland filing requirement. This has not been briefed. It's a brand new argument. But as he said towards the end of his argument, what's required is that you file your form, your standard form agreement. All manufacturers have standard form agreements. That's what has to be filed with the state. With every specific dealer, you have to have a individual agreement concerning that dealer's facility, because you have to have a place where the dealership is going to be housed. And that's always in a separate agreement. And that does not get filed with the state. So that argument, again, not in the briefs, and I submit that it does not change the result here. With respect to Section 15207, as Justice Diaz said, I believe you're correct, and I believe that the Manhattan believes you're correct, that the purpose of Section 15207 is to prevent franchisors from coercing or requiring their existing dealers to do certain things that the dealer did not agree to do when they entered into the relationship. And it's common for franchisors to have term dealer agreements. They'll give the dealer agreement for 2 years, 5 years, and every 2 or 5 years they'll send a new agreement and say, now sign this one. And in fact, the Land Rover dealer agreement in this case is a four-year term agreement. You can see that term on page 555 of the appendix. And in the Wooten case, in which both parties cited in their briefs, it was a series of 2 years agreements. And what the legislature was trying to prevent was that after the dealer gets into the relationship and has an agreement as to the facility it's going to provide, that the manufacturer can't send a new agreement saying, all right, now sign this one, and it's got these brand new requirements in it.
You mean prematurely or in succession?
Later on. In other words, I signed an agreement in 2006, and we agree that I have to have a 2,000 square foot showroom. And it's a 2 year or 4 year term agreement. Then when I send the renewal, I say, well, now you got to have a 3,000 square foot. That's when the statute becomes relevant. And I believe that Manhattan has said that in its own brief. At page 31 of its brief, it says that Section 15207 prohibits a manufacturer from requiring or coercing a dealer to exclude another dealership from the dealer's facilities by franchise agreement or otherwise, or as a condition to the renewal or continuation of a franchise agreement, unless the dealer has already agreed to do so in a franchise agreement. That is, if the dealer's original franchise agreement already states that the dealer will maintain an exclusive facility, the manufacturer may require the dealer to maintain that exclusive facility. And that concession is repeated at page 37 of their brief. So what happened here? Manhattan wanted to acquire a Land Rover dealership and add it to its existing Lincoln, Mercury, and Jaguar facility. Now, nobody required Manhattan to acquire the Land Rover franchise. And Manhattan had no right to become a Land Rover dealer without complying with Land Rover's facility requirements. Land Rover had no obligation to appoint Manhattan as a Land Rover dealer if Manhattan didn't satisfy the facility requirements. And in fact, Manhattan secured an out in their purchase agreement with Rockville Land Rover, saying that if we don't like Land Rover's franchise requirements, we can get out of this deal. So if Manhattan didn't like the requirements, they didn't have to buy the deal. They were not bound by their asset purchase agreement to go ahead with the transaction if they didn't like the requirements. But instead, what they did was they negotiated an agreement with Jaguar and Land Rover, and that agreement is the letter of intent and the performance agreement. So no one coerced Manhattan to do anything. It chose to enter into these agreements, and Jaguar Land Rover's enforcement of those agreements does not violate Section 15207. There are two provisions that they focused on. 207B, which says you can't coerce a dealer to make any agreement. Well, that clearly didn't happen here. He entered the agreement in 2006, no compulsion. He could have turned it down and said, I don't like your requirements. I don't like your facility requirements. I'm not going to acquire the dealership. 207D says that you can't require or coerce a dealer by franchise agreement or otherwise, or as a condition to the renewal or continuation of the franchise, to exclude, to de-dual, as Mr. Weiss puts it, or to impose facility requirements that would be cause undue hardship. And as Judge Chazanow said, under the case law in Maryland, the Antwerp and Dodge case, that statute was interpreted as requiring compulsion, and it was also interpreted as having the same standard, the same concept, as the automobile dealer Day in Court Act cases, which all say that saying to another party that I demand that you comply with your contract is not coercion. In addition to that, there is a definition of require in the statute, and I have to say that Judge Chazanow's decision didn't focus on it, and that's because the parties didn't focus on it below. It wasn't argued below. There's an argument made about it in the brief here. It's section 207A3. I would submit that definition just confirms that her decision is correct. That definition says that require means to impose upon. Impose upon is the first part of it. A provision not required by law or not previously agreed to by a dealer in a franchise agreement. Well, here, these provisions were not imposed upon Manhattan. Manhattan agreed to them as a condition of acquiring Land Rover and of obtaining Jaguar's permission to add Land Rover to the facility. And secondly, at the time of the alleged enforcement in 2008, the facility provisions had been previously agreed to by the dealer in a franchise agreement, i.e., the letter of intent that was signed back in 2006. And the definition, there's a definitional section of franchise in the statute that says the franchise is the written arrangement pursuant to which the rights of the franchise are granted. And that letter of intent, as Judge Chazanow found, was clearly part of that written arrangement. Finally, I'd just like to deal briefly with the good faith argument. We would submit that based on the authority cited in our brief, under Maryland law, demanding that another party to a contract perform that contract is not a lack of good faith. The district judge applied a two-part test that she derived from cases in other states that have good faith provisions in their motor vehicle franchise statutes. And under that test, there's no basis for a lack of good faith claim if, first, the franchisor has a legitimate interest in enforcing its rights, and second, has no ulterior motive. And taking those two elements in reverse, I would submit there's not even been an allegation of an ulterior motive in this case, much less proof of one. And Jaguar and Land Rover obviously have an interest in enforcing the business builder rules because it won't be able to maintain the program if it can't enforce those rules. This is a national program. It applies to all of our dealers, and the rules apply to all dealers. And it's not just or fair for a dealer such as Manhattan to be a free rider in that program and receive the same payments as dealers who've actually made the investment in a facility that complies with Jaguar and Land Rover's requirements. If there are no questions, I have nothing else.
Thank you very much, you. Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Weiss, you have some time reserved for rebuttal.
I'm going to make this brief. Let me address the last point about the National Business Builder Program. What you didn't hear from Mr. Sullivan or in the record is that the Business Builder Program nationally required the de-dueling of Lincoln Mercury franchises from every other dealer. The only evidence we have is that it was a requirement imposed on this dealer. Mr. Jaffe testified and gave an affidavit in this case that he would not have entered into the agreement but for the representation that he could retain Lincoln Mercury until such time as the other dealership, the Land Rover, was reasonably profitable. And so we have a situation in which we want to use the integration clause to keep out that evidence in the case, and yet we want to conflagrate the integration clause with these two other agreements and say they're all part of the same. Second point, there were disputed facts. I believe this is a case, we never had an oral argument, that should have gone forward to trial and let the court or a jury, if there was a jury, to be impaneled to decide the issues in this case. The other issue was that the dealership provided both at the trial level and in the appendix evidence that it sought to comply. It brought plans. It involved Jaguar Land Rover in the zoning process. There are memos from Shulman Rogers, the zoning firm, about the issues that were going on in White Flint. So it wasn't a dealer that was asking for a free ride. It was a dealer like many other dealers that where they were making the effort, they would be entitled to the Business Builder Program. Unlike other dealers, they had the imposed requirement to remove the Lincoln Mercury franchise. And I submit to you that this case should not have been granted on summary judgment. I ask you to reverse and remand the case. Thank you.
Thank you. We will come down, greet counsel, and take a brief recess.